a lot of what the U.S. is doing in terms of place-based policy looks like what development economists have been studying in low-income countries for the past couple of decades. What does the developing world have to teach us about what works with regards to place-based policy? The learning is going both ways.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Place-based policy is undergoing a revival at the moment, but how does it work and what can it deliver? Gordon Hanson of Harvard has spent many years studying the economic importance of where people live and what policy can do to improve those places. I wanted to ask him about what has worked in the US and what can be applied in a development context from that. So when we spoke, I started by asking him, if place-based policy is being revived, why did it fall out of favor in the first place?
But when we say a revival, that's from the perspective of mainstream economics, which tends to pretend that things don't exist if economists aren't studying it. There have been practitioners on the ground actively experimenting with place-based policy over the past couple of decades, but it's been largely below the radar screen of academic researchers and of a lot of policy folks in Washington, D.C. A handful of scholars have been tracking this stuff. Tim Bartik at the Upjohn Institute, David Newmark at UC Irvine, they've been doing work all along, Enrico Moretti and Pat Klein at UC Berkeley. But we have a renewed interest now in part because of a sense of intense need in regions that have been set by decades of joblessness.
And so economists are recognizing, well, the existence of place-based policy, but are they starting to believe that it can deliver more of what those regions need?
Well, on the back of the causal revolution in economics and the intense interest in well-identified policy treatment effects, folks are always looking around for new things to study. And as they've done so, they've discovered that there's just a wealth of place-based policy interventions that have escaped our attention in times past and now have begun to apply those tools that we've developed over the past couple of decades to policy areas that we kind of just not entirely ignored, but mostly ignored. And what we're finding is evidence of success and evidence of failure. The evidence of success is in some sense surprising because I think it was a prior of many mainstream economists that these policies just don't work. And so the combination of a sense of serious need in places with high joblessness and accumulating evidence that certain types of interventions are successful is now leading to something of a rethink.
Now, before we talk about what works and what doesn't, we should really establish what we're talking about. Now, it occurs to me that all policies are delivered in a place, but of course that doesn't make them place-based policies. What specifically do we mean when we talk about place-based policy?
There's not an accepted definition, so I'm going to give you my own.
Okay.
And my own is that place-based policies are one that are intentionally trying to change economic outcomes in a locality. There are many other policies that are unintentionally place-based or incidentally place-based. And that ranges from where we put military bases to where we locate major hospitals, actually the U.S. tax code, because we have tax brackets that are indexed to nominal income and more expensive places pay more than less expensive places. It's important to keep track of those incidentally place-based policies, but our focus is really on ones that were designed to help improve employment and earnings outcomes in places that are in distress.
So to be specific, when we're talking about development policy, what does this include as the candidates? And I guess also, what does it exclude?
So again, there's not a well-accepted definition, so I'll give you another one of my own. And so I define it in terms of four domains. And you can think of those domains as features of elements of the neoclassical production function, trying to enhance labor through workforce development, trying to promote the accumulation of capital by attracting business through tax incentives, or by trying to promote the development of indigenous small business, trying to enhance the managerial capabilities, the technology that's available in a place, and then trying to improve the utilization of land. And that happens via tax incentives for investing in low-income areas.
And are there policies that we might think would be place-based, but that really don't fit your definition?
where things get blurry is when we talk about a place, the distinction between a region mm-hmm. and a neighborhood.
Okay.
A lot of folks study how we can improve outcomes in disadvantaged neighborhoods inside otherwise successful cities. Again, my metric here is policies that are intended to change the labor market equilibrium in an entire local labor market and not just focus on specific communities that have experienced hardship.
Who's best placed to deliver place-based policies then? I guess when we're talking about the national government has the resources because the sorts of policies you're talking about can be quite expensive and are quite intensive. But then again, local governments and local people have the knowledge of where those policies would work best.
This is a great question, and it's something that my colleague Danny Roderick and I have been working on. We have a paper which we'll release in early 2024 called How Does Place-Based Policy Work? In which we just ask the question, who actually delivers place-based policy? And how it all works is just not at all what we thought. So you have three levels of actors. The federal government provides much of the money, and this works through federal legislation that was in decades past, usually in response to a crisis moment. We've got to do something about worker training. Our worker training programs actually date back to legislation in 1962 when, oddly enough, the concern was the impact that automation would have on the labor market in 1962.
Wow.
It was later hijacked to become something else, more of a social welfare program. There's similar stories behind the Small Business Administration, which obviously helps small business, Economic Development Administration, which helps regions figure out what their plan should be, and then targeted investing in low-income areas that evolved out of the Community Reinvestment Act. So that money is out there in these big tranches subject to specific rules and protocols, but the government doesn't go knocking on your door saying, here's money. It's demand driven. You qualify, but you need to go get it. And getting it often involves creating the right sort of intermediary. That could be the right type of bank. It could be a small business development center. It could be an economic development agency that can then apply for federal money. This feature of needing these intermediaries is enormously important because it means that many places with low capacity never even get in the queue. So at the local level, what folks are doing is they're designing the strategy. The strategy is not coming from Washington. Strategy is coming at the local level, even if much of the money might arrive from higher levels of government. And this is where the most interesting experimentation is going on. But there is a huge amount of heterogeneity in the capacity of places to undertake that experimentation. Sitting in between the national and the local are state governments. And this is a bit of a caricature, but state governments, you can think of to a first approximation as being governors obsessed with reelection and how do they improve reelection prospects. They go attract a trophy firm to come locate somewhere within the boundaries of the state. And they do so via generous tax incentives.
Now, I want to talk about those incentives because in high-income countries, Europe, where I live, in North America, where you are, then we're used to seeing the policy levers as being subsidies and grants and tax breaks. Are they the only mechanisms? And when we talk about other types of economies, are they the best mechanisms to use?
I think this is one area in which research has something of a consensus answer, and that consensus answer is no. But let me be a little bit more precise in terms of what we're talking about. The use of tax incentives to attract large mobile companies that are figuring out where they want to open a new facility. What happens as states or cities or counties begin to compete for the interests of these companies is that the companies then kind of dictate, well, what are the local options that are on the table? And they're going to end up excluding a lot of the regions that we want place-based policy to focus on. So you end up with competition between regions that are already doing pretty well to get the trophy firm. And that means that almost by definition, when these companies arrive, they aren't going to raise the employment rate. They're just going to reallocate the employment rate from what the place was doing before to the industry that's now receiving these grants. There's great work by Kaylin Slattery at at UC Berkeley, which documents kind of what happens in this domain and how much of the benefits of economic development then flow to those firms. But this is just one part of place-based policy. And you think of it as accounting for, I don't know, about a third of total spending. There's a lot of really interesting stuff that happens in terms of career and technical education and support for small business that we tend to ignore because it's not as exciting as ribbon cuttings. Those are the instances in which policy seems to be more successful.
As you say, we tend to concentrate and be distracted by the arrival of these large investments and huge firms in regions, especially in emerging economies. You hear a lot about this. What can place-based policies do, though, to improve the outcomes for firms that are already in that region that aren't doing well?
To answer that question, which is the right question, where we want to start, we got to just be clear about the problem we're trying to solve. In my own mind, I think of this as, you know, how do we help regions that have experienced hardship of some type, typically adverse shocks to what had been their major industries? You get a bunch of job loss as a consequence. We know job loss is scarring. So there are two things we're trying to accomplish in the aftermath of that job loss. One is triage, helping workers who are in the throes of job loss not experience a downward cycle of economic distress, but to right themselves. And we know that more generous and longer lasting unemployment insurance benefits during periods of high joblessness really help people avoid these sudden contractions in consumption spending and the ability to invest in anything or send your kids to college or get training or whatever. So that's the frontline response. Over time, these places that have been beset by joblessness, even though unemployment is high, and a simple model would say, oh, their firms should be lining up to come and hire these cheap workers, doesn't work like that. There's good economic reasons why firms tend to avoid places with high unemployment. And so what that means is there are binding constraints on access to credit that impede either workers getting the training they need to change sectors or that small business needs to open and move into new areas. And we know that almost all job growth comes from young small firms. Declining regions experience a dearth of the creation of those high growth young small firms. So those are the margins, relaxing constraints on the accumulation of new types of human capital and physical capital.
When we're developing human capital, though, I know that we've covered several experiments in this and policies in this throughout the developing world. It takes a long time to do that, and it's very hard work to do it. Can these sort of policies show results quickly?
They actually can. I mentioned earlier, one of the really surprising things is just how does all of this work? Delivering the type of training that workers need in order to go from the industry where they might have been working for 5 or 10 years or that where their parents had worked and they expected to work to now to something new. Community colleges do this through career and technical education. These are certificate programs. You're not going on to get a BA degree. These are terminal training programs in welding, to be a radiology technician, to be a firefighter, in different types of advanced manufacturing, to be a get a commercial driver's license. They last from 12 to 24 months, and they give individuals a very nice bump in earnings. Not as much as you get in getting a BA degree, but that's just not on the table for the vast majority of workers that we're talking about. The best community colleges, and think of those as kind of being in the top quartile, are really good at this. When unemployment goes up in an area, they really increase the supply of this career and technical education because that's when workers want it. And this speeds adjustment. The median community college, however, is not so good at this. And then the bottom third are really bad at it. And this is kind of one of the puzzles. If we know what should be done, why is it not being done in more places? The basic approach to worker training that we know works, which combine wraparound services and career counseling and soft skills development and then occupation-specific training, they're actually developed 25 years ago. The challenge is how do we replicate and scale the programs that have been shown to be successful in randomized controlled trials?
There always is a lot of policy focus, isn't there, on developing higher education. And what you're saying here is that what moves the needle is that really high quality education that's suiting young people for the sorts of jobs that they are likely to get, which might have nothing to do with the universities at all.
when Kodak went bankrupt in Rochester, New York, for a while, just catastrophic for the local economy. Kodak in earlier decades had helped develop one of the best technical training programs in optics at Monroe Community College, located there in the city. That program survived Kodak's bankruptcy because it was already there. It's already operating. Mm-hmm. And then fed in well-trained workers to a new generation of optics firms who aren't doing photography. They're doing other stuff because optics shows up everywhere. And that's helped the region adjust. What we see going on right now in southern states, so Georgia in particular, and around Atlanta in particular, is trying to ramp up the ability to produce electric vehicles. That means making batteries, and making batteries means having workers with the right manufacturing skills. It's community colleges that are providing those skills. Mm-hmm. When Pittsburgh had to figure out how it adjusted from being a steel economy and a fossil fuel-based economy to being something else, and it ultimately became an economy based on medical services, medical devices, robotics, and other stuff in tech, Allegheny Community College was central to that. So were Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh, but most of the jobs were not for workers with a BA. They were for workers without a BA. So the great thing about community colleges, they're everywhere. There are about 1,400 in the United States. Not every community has one. There are many places that just don't have access, but they're an existing institution that, when it works really well for the local economy.
One of the objections that you often hear about place-based policies is that it doesn't matter where you are in the world, budgets are limited. If you give more resources and you focus on one place, you are taking those resources from another place. Is that accurate?
Well, budgets are limited. So anytime you say we should spend more money in place A, place B is going to miss out a bit. But if we go back to the intent of the policy is designed to help places that are hurting. If you look at the flow of funding in these different domains, whether it be funding for community colleges, small business loans, tax breaks for big companies, and then ask the question, are these funds going in larger quantities to places with higher joblessness? The answer is mostly no. Assistance to small business goes overwhelmingly to places where joblessness is really low. We've created a system that just tracks the credit market. We aren't doing any redistribution. Mm-hmm. So before we think about adding any additional funding to the system, we can reallocate funding to meet its original design in a way that could move the needle. I can't guarantee it would move the needle, but we aren't living up to the original intent of the policies we put in place. And that, to me, seems to be the obvious place to start.
So week by week, when I talk to policymakers and I talk to researchers, then yes, we talk about the need to develop skills and the need to improve outcomes in some places. But then we also talk about the problems of climate change, the problems of conflict. When you're in development situations, would it sometimes be better, rather than improving a place, just to give people the chance to migrate away from it?
This is a perennial question in thinking about place-based policy. Are we getting in the way of what would be more effective and successful labor market adjustment in the long run? And there are places where just no amount of money is going to restore the wages and employment to where they were at the peak of, say, coal production in coal mining communities or steelmaking in steelmaking regions. Mm-hmm. And so some places will end up being permanently smaller. So for those places, the question is, how do we get to the smaller economy? Pittsburgh got there. Pittsburgh is smaller than it used to be. But man, was it a painful adjustment. It took more than a full generation to get there. So part of place-based policy is about smoothing adjustment. Doesn't necessarily mean we're trying to make places bigger in the long run. We're trying to make their arrival at their new state of being in the new set of industries that they're going to be specializing in less traumatic than it tends to be on average. So that's one point. A second point is, it's just really hard to get people to leave their region. They might be willing to relocate within a broader regional context, but not between regions. That interregional mobility is really low. And economists are just sort of incredulous about this because we're taught when we study urban models, the spatial equilibrium condition. Labor mobility flows between places to equalize real standards of living, full stop. Mm-hmm. That was always an assertion. it was never a fact. And we haven't done a good job establishing that the fact is in fact true. The reason we love that assumption is because it makes our models so tractable, but it gets in the way of understanding what types of interventions we want to contemplate in different regions.
Now, the lives of the poorest people on the planet are entirely different, even to the lives of the people who are just slightly richer than them. When we're thinking about place-based policy like this, should we really not be thinking instead about targeting any interventions just at the people that need it wherever they are?
So there are two kind of deep motivations for place-based policy. One, efficiency, one, equity. And I've been talking more about the efficiency motivations for place-based policy, but you could have added an equity dimension or equity justification to almost everything I said.
Yeah.
When it comes to regions that are really, really poorly off and where you would take massive subsidies to reactivate the economy, then people-based policy, just targeted subsidies to maintain consumption levels among those who are objectively poor, may be a vastly superior policy. So the issue isn't that place-based policy should replace the social welfare state and targeting people based on their economic conditions, but making sure we get the balance right in terms of the economic potential of places.
Often you find as well in places that are struggling that the institutions are weak or ineffective. The great advantage of, say, the community college system in the United States is it's there, it's been there for a long time. In places that have ineffective, weak institutions, perhaps a weak social safety net, can place-based policies work well?
This is probably one of the three most important questions. I'd have to think about what the other two, but I know this would make the top three in terms of understanding how to make place-based policy effective. And this goes back to something we were talking about earlier in terms of government putting money on the table, but communities need to organize themselves to get that money. And so state capacity matters, and civil society ends up being enormously important. Now, the good news here is if you look at the actors involved, what you see is de Tocqueville in action. Local organizations arising spontaneously to solve local problems. And there are many examples of these sorts of economic development organizations. They might have some funding from local government. They might be public-private partnerships. They might be organized out of a community college. You can have labor unions leading the charge. You've even got church leaders in different places occupying that role of civic champion, helping bring people to the table to think about convening and coordinating so we can find a strategy that will work. Low-income places have evidence of this sort of organizing. Now, on average, they have less of it than higher-income places do. And this is where, just as a scholar, I'm kind of most intrigued. Well, how do you then help civil society organize itself better so that then it can take over? But it's an enormously difficult question. What we're trying to do right now is measure that capacity by cataloging every type of economic development organization that we can find in every commuting zone in the United States. And this includes single-purpose entities that are there to say community development financial institutions that are all about investing in low-income communities or community colleges or small business development centers. But it also includes these multi-purpose organizations that are really about the strategy. If you look at the industrial development of the U.S. South, which is an incredibly poor region in 1940, it was the kind of the local chamber of commerce that organized a lot of this. And you had in a book by James Cobb, an historian called Selling the South in 1993, he said he cataloged around 1,200 different chamber of commerce or similar type organizations across the South involved in local economic development. So poor places can form the organizational structure that's needed. How we bring that about and how we can help places choose policies that are best suited for them, that's a much tougher question.
Well, I'm going to ask you the tougher question to finish off. You have a lot of experience of what works in the United States context. So let me take you out of there and make you a policymaker in somewhere different, in Africa or an Asian economy. Are there undervalued place-based policies that you think have potential for the policymakers in those places that maybe aren't employed often enough?
oddly enough, a lot of what the U.S. is doing in terms of place-based policy looks like what development economists have been studying in low-income countries for the past couple of decades. So there's celebrated work on how giving management training to small business folks improve their productivity and sales in the long run. Hmm. The U.S. government supports exactly those sorts of interventions through the Small Business Administration, which funds small business development centers that give technical advice to small business. So the odd thing is, it's really, what does the developing world have to teach us about what works with regards to place-based policy? The learning is going both ways. These sorts of active labor market programs I was mentioning earlier were developed in the U.S. They now have been tried all over the developing world. Their success is mixed. There are environments in which they work well. There are environments in which they don't work well. Mm-hmm. So they're not magic bullets here. But in all of these instances, people, they're identifying what the problem is. Barriers to the accumulation of the skills that workers need, barriers to accumulating capital to launch a business that can grow into a 100 or 200 person shop. And the institutional context might differ vastly across these countries, but the problems they're trying to solve are pretty similar.
Well, let's hope that policy learning and success continues to go both ways, Gordon. Thank you for talking about it today.
Thank you very much, Tim. This has been a real pleasure.
You can find out more about his work by looking up the Reimagining the Economy project, which is based at the Malcolm Wiener Center for Social Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. It explores local labor markets, industrial and development policies to reshape the narratives about how we achieve inclusive prosperity. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.